We're here to tour David Foster Wallace's Boston. There's a book called Infinite Jest. You may know it's 1,000 pages long. It's some people say it's one of the greatest books of the last 100 years. Some people say it's a complete piece of nonsense. I'm in the former camp. And the amazing thing about it is, like James Joyce's Ulysses, it maps Boston in this very interesting way. Unlike James Joyce, like James Joyce said, if Dublin was destroyed, you could rebuild Dublin based on my book. You really can't do that with Infinite Jest. You could build a slightly altered Boston, a slightly strange Boston in Cambridge. It's Wallace's Boston in Cambridge. So that's what we're here to look at. So we're going to start here. We're in Harvard Square, where some of the action takes place. One of the things about Wallace's Boston is that we've got all these magnificent institutions around us, the churches, so much history, so much like of the glory of America is here, and the kind of thing that we're really proud of. We're not talking about that. We're talking a lot about the drug addicts, the downside of society, the unhappiness, and some of the and the lives of addicts. Addicts, whether they're addicted to television, to drugs, to crime, all forms of addiction. Most tours would go in a logical fashion that would lead to a kind of a climax. This is a postmodern tour, in the same way that Infinite Jest is a postmodern book. It's a little bit random, in the same way that the order of the book is a little bit random. So we're starting in the middle and we're going to end in the middle. And now we're going to take a walk down to the Harvard Homeless Shelter, where another character lived. So here we are at 45 Winthrop Street. This is one of the ambiguous addresses in Infinite Jest. We're not quite sure if this is the exact place. It's referred to as the Cambridge City Shelter in the book. But here's the Harvard Homeless Shelter, where Harvard students work. Wallace was a student at Harvard. He may have worked here. We don't know. One thing I want to say is that there's something very odd about this tour, which is that the book is so beautiful and full of so much joy and so funny, so hilariously funny, that you almost don't notice that there's so much despair and suffering in the book. And so I think it's good to start at a place like a homeless shelter, because so much of the book is about that kind of thing. There's a tension in the book between, on the one hand, it's this postmodern, joyous, funny jumble of science and, of course, we don't believe in God and faithlessness. And yet there's this tremendous yearning for faith and a looking toward finding a way to find something to believe in that supports you in life and doesn't destroy you. So I was just going to mention, it gets brighter. Fun to think about him walking these streets and noting everything down. It's kind of almost seems like photographic memory. Now we're going to go just across the street to a very, very different Boston, Cambridge, the Cambridge of Harvard University, this way. It's a pure, it's a labor of love, you know. It's an obsession and a love. And it's also a way of kind of understanding the book. The book is so hard to get your head around, and it haunts you so much because it almost makes sense, but not quite. And I like this idea that writers turn the real world into their own world. Every book you read is its own world. And there's something very, very appealing to me about a certain kind of power and a certain kind of dream world that a reader enters into. So you're simultaneously walking in the real Boston and the Boston of his imagination. We're in front of Cambridge City Hospital, where poor Tony, you may remember, the addict with the feather boa around his neck, he has a seizure, as he is wont to do. And he decides he's very fortunate to be taken to Cambridge City Hospital. And this is why. Hospitals show you a kind of inverted respect. A place like Cambridge City Hospital bows to your will not to stay. They all of a sudden defer to your subjective diagnostic knowledge of your own condition, which post-seizure condition you feel has turned the corner toward improvement. They bow to your quixotic will. It's unfortunately not a free hospital, but it is a free country. They honor your wishes and compliment your mambo and say, go with God. So he has no health care, so they throw him out. And he's very happy because he's right down the street from Inman Square, which is the best place to score the best drugs, which is where we're heading now.
Was Inman Square reliably a good drug market?
I have no idea. It's beyond my knowledge. But it's where Wallace lived.
Yeah.
And Wallace was not a big drug addict, by the way. He was not an IV drug user, to the extent that we know. He was an alcoholic and a big pot smoker.
Yeah.
But not hardcore. He's getting all this hardcore stuff from the folks he meets at the Apple House.
I find this part of the interesting thing. I mean, he made himself a better tennis player than he was, in fact, and yes. he made himself a lesser substance abuser than yes. than he seems now to have been.
Yes, although in interviews he always denied that. He always said that I was not a good tennis player. Don't say I was a good tennis player. You're insulting all the good tennis players, and it embarrasses me for you to say that. I think, yeah, he had an odd relationship with the truth in his writing. He didn't feel that, I don't think he really understood when he was writing nonfiction that it was supposed to be factual.
And why should it be?
Yeah. So he had no problem changing things around to make the story better. So we're going to head back to Wallace's apartment now. So this is a section of Somerville that hasn't changed much. If there were to be a plaque put anywhere for up to Wallace in the Boston area, I think it would be here. This is 35 Houghton Street, in just outside Inman Square, or on the Somerville side. And he lived here for 6 short months with his best friend, the lawyer and novelist Mark Costello. And this was where they had a very wild time. He came in April of 89. He stayed here until his breakdown around Halloween of 89. And they spent the summer. Mark was working as a lawyer. David was mostly drinking, smoking pot, going out to bars at night, and writing ferociously, obsessively, manically, 10, 20,000 words a day. I don't know if any of the stories he wrote here wound up in Infinite Jest. I tend to think not, but maybe so. And Costello described, there's an essay he wrote about this period of time, and Costello summed it up by saying, quote, "There was no shortage of chaos around 35 Houghton Street, apartment 2. Lost bills went unpaid. The phone rang at 3 a.m., and women banged on the back door 2 hours later." So, it's a fun time. They wrote a book called Signifying Rappers during this period of time. If I could have been anywhere, I would have liked to have been at some of those parties. They sounded like a good time. There's a joke in the book about one of the mother character's classes is called the personal is the political is the psychopathological. And it seems like just a throwaway joke, but in fact, I think this is what Wallace was onto, that there's a connection between personal problems that people have and the culture that we live in, that the culture is setting up conditions that you respond to. And I don't know, in the biography, D.T. Maxx tends to say, well, this was an excuse, really, Wallace had for explaining his own problems. But for me, I think there's a lot to it. We live in a consumer society. I just read the Nielsen rating that the average American watches 5.1 hours of television a day. That 49% of kids age 9 would rather spend time watching television than time with their father. It's corrosive. It's corrosive, and it's very, very hard to look at. We're here at the site of what is now Whole Foods, which is across all over the country, but back in the 80s, if you're a resident, you'll remember Bread and Circus, which a lot of us call Bread and Checkbook. And he describes Bread and Circus. Gately had decided to buy the newcomer's omelet stuff at Bread and Circus in Inman Square, Cambridge. It will explain delay, and it will be a subtle nonverbal stab at unique dietary requests in general. Bread and Circus is a socially hyper-responsible, overpriced grocery full of Cambridge Green Party granola crunchers. And everything's like microbiotic and fertilized only with organic, genuine llama shit, etc. We're heading out through BU now into Alston on our way to Brighton and the fictional Enfield. If you're a Wallace nut, if you've read the book, you start to get excited around here because we're approaching Granada House, which was turned into Ennett House in the novel. And this is where the denizens lived in Infinite Jest. And in the book, it's just as in reality. The frustrating thing is that the subway stop is right here, the T stop's right here, and you want to just cross the street and get up there, but you can't because there's this small ravine and a fence all the way. So in the book, the residents are constantly carping about having to walk all the way around, and that's exactly what we have to do now. This is the Brighton Marine Health Center, which gets changed into the book into the Enfield Marine Health Center. Wallace invented a separate town inside of Brighton called Enfield. So we're gonna head up and look for Granada House. So these buildings are still numbered. The numbering seems to be the same as in the book. This is the Addiction Treatment Center of New England. This is one of the catatonics live there, and it leads to a digressive conversation that Hal has with the cops down at the bar, which is called The Unexamined Life, which I love.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
And the cops refer to the catatonics as he writes, objet d'arts. This is the actual place, this in 1989-90, when Wallace was here from about the 1st of December 1989 to about the 1st of June or July 1990. At that time it was called Grenada House. He turned it in the book into Ennett House, and this is where he lived with a roommate called Big Craig, who was thought to be the basis of Don Gately, the hero of the book, one of the other heroes of the book. And he describes it this way. Unit 6, right up against the ravine on the end of the Rutted Rose east side, is Ennett House Drug and Alcohol Recovery House. Three stories of whitewashed New England brick, with the brick showing in patches through the whitewash, a mansard roof that sheds green shingles, a scabrous fire escape at each upper window, and a back door no resident is allowed to use, and a front office around on the south side with huge protruding bay windows that yield a view of ravine weeds and the unpleasant stretch of Commonwealth Avenue. One of Ennett House's live-in staffers' rotating PM jobs is just to be awake and on call in the front office all night for dream duty. People in early recovery from substances often get hit with real horror show dreams or else traumatically seductive substance dreams, and sometimes trite but important epiphanic dreams. And the staffer on dream duty is required to be up doing paperwork or sit-ups or staring out the broad bay window in the front office downstairs, ready to make coffee and listen to the residents' dreams and offer the odd, practical, upbeat Boston AA type insight into the possible implications for the dreamer's progress in recovery. So, this place meant a lot to him. It still exists. It's moved to a different place. It's called the Granada Recovery House, and seems to be just a wonderful, wonderful place. Well, Wallace says he wants the reader to do their share of linguistic work. We're doing our share of physical work today. I'm trying to explain this whole postmodern thing and the disillusion, and it's very, very hard to explain, I think, to younger people the paroxysm of the Vietnam War and Watergate and how.
What is the postmodern connection, Bill?
Well, just the falling apart of the grand narrative of America and the West, that you just don't believe it anymore.
Yeah.
That, you know, the American exception, that we're about truth and justice and freedom. And it was hard to go through that experience and not think, you know, we're kind of about power and empire and greed and money. And it was always us. The scales fell from our eyes. And that cynicism seeps its way into popular culture. So that's one reason why you can't write like Charles Dickens, because you're not, you know, I think Dickens thought that he's going to write this book, people are going to read it, society will do what's right, and conditions will improve. And I think that notion was given up for a long time. Now it's just, you know, utopia, it's a joke. It's a joke. And I think we're also trying to push past that. Because it's as you say, you want to kill yourself.
That's good.
So this is the site, this monastery up here on top of the hill above where we were, the Brighton Marine Health Center, that is the site, we think, as close as we can come to Enfield Tennis Academy and where it was. Enfield Tennis Academy is a place of high achievement, is a place of no faith in God, it is a place of pressure, it is a place where the kids are on drugs from age of 12 on as a way of coping with this extreme pressure of high achievement, both athletically and intellectually. Mario, the simplistic son, likes to wander down from the Enfield Tennis Academy down to the Ennett House, and this is his description as the sun is setting of one of his rambles down there. Mario keeps to a pretty limited area during insomniacal strolls out of deference to Avril's worry. He'll sometimes walk around the grounds of Enfield Marine PHH at the bottom of the hill's east side, because they're pretty much enclosed, the grounds are, and he knows a couple of the EM security officers from when his father got to portray Boston police in his whimsical Dial C for Concupiscence. And he likes the EM grounds at night because the different brick houses' window light is yellow lamplight, and he can see people on the ground floor all together playing cards or talking or watching TP. He also likes the whitewashed brick, regardless of its state of upkeep. And a lot of the people in different brick houses are damaged or askew and lean hard to one side or are twisted into themselves through the windows. And he can feel his heart going out in the world through them, which is good for insomnia. A woman's voice calling for help without any real urgency, not like the screams that signify the moms laughing or screaming at night, sounds from a darkened upper window. And across the little street that's crammed with cars everybody has to move at 000 hours is Ennett House, where the headmistress has a disability and has had a wheelchair ramp installed and has twice invited Mario in during the day for a caffeine-free millennial fizzy. And Mario likes the place. It's crowded and noisy, and none of the furniture has protective plastic wrap, but nobody notices anybody else or comments on disability, and it smells like an ashtray. But Mario's felt good both times in Ennett House because it's very real. People are crying and making noise and getting less unhappy. And once he heard somebody say God with a straight face, and nobody looked down or smiled in any sort of way where you could tell they were worried inside. That's not the whole story, but it's part of the story. It's a very real part of the story that gets thrown out a lot in our world today. So thank you for coming on the tour. It's The Endless Infinite Boston of Infinite Jest. It's a book with no beginning and no end. We didn't cover it all. Nobody ever covers it all. Nobody ever will cover it all. The book is just going to be there for us to get from it what we can, including me. Thanks very much.